This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we'll hear about a study that shows not all breeds of cattle are the same when it comes to the fat content of their meat. A University of Florida researcher joins us to talk about the search for the good fats in beef a little later in the show. But first, if you've never been there, Cayo Costa off the coast of Lee County is the largest unspoiled state park island in the Gulf of Mexico, more than 2,400 acres of land and 7 miles of beach. It's only accessible by boat with ferry services from Pine Island, Captiva, and Punta Gorda. There are miles of trails, primitive cabins, and tent sites, and there are park rangers on hand to offer tours and historical context about the island. And the island's history runs deep, from the pioneers who settled it in the 1800s to the Colusa Indians, who lived there for thousands of years. That history is told in a new independent documentary called Mullet and Mangroves, which airs starting tomorrow night on WGCU-TV. On today's show, we're talking to explore that history and hear about what's happening on the island these days with two women who know the island well. Elaine McLaughlin is volunteer chair for a group called Friends of Cayo Costa. Elaine, thanks for being with us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much for having us.
And Sharon McKenzie is the executive director of the Barrier Island Parks Society. Sharon, we appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. If you spent time on Cayo Costa, maybe you've spent the night out there in one of the cabins, give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Elaine and Sharon, I have to admit, pronunciation, it's been an issue for me on this one. I keep calling it Cayo Costa because that's kind of what I read it to sound like. But, you know, I haven't lived here all my life and gone to visit the place. So how do locals pronounce it?
Well, it depends where the locals are from. If they're part of the original pioneer families, we often hear the pronunciation Cayo Costa because they did descend from Spanish families. So they know the proper pronunciation for that name and for the major surname, which was Padilla. But locals tend to say Cayo Costa.
Cayo Costa. Okay, so that's how locals say it.
People that are not pioneer families. So,
not pioneer families.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say locals are pioneer families. So the pioneer families that have been around for multiple generations.
They're the original locals.
The original locals.
Well, kind of original locals.
Yes. Because I'm like now considered a local, but I'm not an original local. So original locals, they say Cayo Costa.
Cayo Costa. Okay.
Right.
So it's a Spanish thing that I'm doing. Okay. Well, and I kept on trying to say it the other way. I kept messing it up. Anyway, so tell me a little bit about Elaine. I'll start with you. Like, tell me a little bit about Friends of Cayo Costa, which I'm going to continue to say it that way. I apologize, even though I'm not a descendant of the original settlers. How did you first get involved with the Friends of Cayo Costa?
Well, when I was part of the Friends of Florida State Parks, which was a bigger organization, all the state parks in the state, I was invited to participate with a new group called the Friends of Cayo Costa, which is a subgroup of the Barrier Island Park Society. We are, however, an all-volunteer group. Mm-hmm. Everybody is just one hardworking volunteer after another. And so I've been involved since the inception, which has been about eight years now.
Yeah. So 8 years ago.
8 years ago.
And it formed with what mission?
It formed with the mission of specifically paying attention to nurturing the nature and the history of Cayo Costa and sharing that with the world, promoting the island, educating about the island. So that is really our mission.
So you said it's all volunteer. How many volunteers do you have, more or less?
We have a steering committee of 12 members, and we accomplish quite a bit with 12 members. We're very excited about it. And, of course, then we have other people who contribute periodically, but our steering committee does the heavy lifting.
Okay. Do you remember the first time that you ever visited Cayo Costa?
Yes, I do. Back when I was working for the Tourist Development Council, because I served a time as executive director of the Tourist Development Council, I enjoyed wonderful visits to Cayo Costa with a lot of travel writers and travel journalists, because oftentimes people who come from any other part of the country or the world, we love to take them to Cayo Costa because it is so uniquely different.
What makes it that uniquely different? Just because it hasn't been developed?
Yes, because it's so unspoiled, and it really is much, especially the park part of the island, is much the way it was hundreds of years ago with very little difference other than the few park amenities that are there.
Mm-hmm. So, Sharon McKenzie, tell me a little bit about the Barrier Island Park Society. What is that?
So, Barrier Island Park Society, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. Our mission is to inspire the exploration and preservation of our natural and historic treasures. So our group is quite large. We have over 1,200 members, and we have 20 people that sit on our board. And we manage and operate three historic structures, both the Port Boca Grande Lighthouse and Museum, Gasparilla Island Lighthouse, Amory Memorial Chapel, and we also support four state parks. So Cayo Costa is just one of the four state parks that we support. We also support Don Pedro, Gasparilla, and Stump Pass Beach State Park.
So at Cayo Costa, what exactly then does your organization do? You say support. How? In what way?
So we support we partially financially support as well as the Friends group. So the Friends, their sole mission is just the island. And there are many times that they'll need equipment and we'll pay for half of the equipment. We work directly with the parks to develop educational programs. There's like, for instance, one of them is our Wading Adventures, which is very popular in all our parks. That was a program that we developed. So we do we are considered the citizen support organization. So we're chartered directly with the state to support the four state parks. So we work very closely with the park management to support their parks, to do whatever their needs
are. Sounds
like
a nice partnership.
Yes,
you know?
It is.
They're working together to keep things the way that you want to. How much time do you actually spend on the island itself? Are you there every day?
No, not at all.
Do you want to be?
We do. I would love to be. we have several members of our steering committee, though, who are day-to-day volunteers helping to operate the gift shop. We have one member who drives the tram. And so when people land at the dock on Cayo Costa, they are taken over to the beach side of the island and they're carried over with a tram, and he drives the tram and welcomes people in. His name is Dennis Romig. He's a great volunteer and a longtime Pine Islander.
Oh, yeah. Are there people that live there full-time?
Full-time is a strong word.
Yes, yeah.
So it's very difficult living on an island where you have to bring everything in and to carry everything off. So there's about 23 homes there. Most people go there for the weekends. They're not living there full-time.
Is there electricity?
If you have a generator.
Oh, okay. So people can have a generator for their home?
Right.
Yes.
And then that would be required in the summer for the air conditioning because there's just no way. I don't know. Maybe on an island. How is it out there? Is it a little bit cooler with some ocean breeze?
Yes, definitely cooler with an ocean breeze. But this time of year, especially now through September, you're going to feel the heat.
Do you have people that go out there and stay at those homes over the wintertime, though?
We aren't connected with that. That's part of the south end of the island.
Okay, so when you go to the island, that's kind of a more private residence down there on the south end. What you're talking about is the park side that's on the north
end.
Right, exactly. So when people go there, they take a ferry, they arrive. What do they see?
They get picked up by the tram and they can visit the ranger station where there's some educational material. They can visit the gift shop and then they go over to the beach side. Basically, the beach is the big attractor, although there are some wonderful trails as well. And people go for birding, for seeing wildlife and all of that kind of thing. But they go over to the beach side. They spend the day on the beach side collecting shells. Shelling is very, very popular, of course.
I imagine it collects a lot of shells right there.
Beautiful shells.
And you know, there's not a lot of people picking all of them. You
it's
know, so
certainly less competitive than other parts of the area, yes.
The shell collection competition, yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the history. The history of the island starts with the Calusas, correct?
Yes, exactly.
Do they know how long ago they were there?
Thousands of years ago.
The Calusas about 2,000 years ago.
2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what were their lives like? Do we have any evidence of that?
Yeah, we do. We do. There are some archaeological digs that have happened on the island. And, of course, the Randall Research Center, part of the University of Florida, has done some extensive work on the Calusa, both on the Barrier Islands and also on Pine Island. And there is a wonderful facility on Pine Island where you can learn all about the Calusa Indians.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that the Calusa were fisher folk as well, just like our pioneers.
So do we have shell mounds out there? Are there shell mounds out
there? Yes, there are.
That you can kind of explore around on?
Well, we don't encourage that.
Yeah.
So.
It's like I'm king of the 10-foot-tall hill.
Mm-hmm.
But there is not that much in the way of artifacts that were left from the Calusas.
There are some, but it's not. They're not displayed the way that you see them at Mound Key or the way you see them at in Pineland.
So when people go there, if they're looking for Calusa history, they just kind of are going to get more of a feeling of what it was like to be a Calusa on the island rather than looking at things in a case.
Right.
Exactly. But we do hope down the road, one of our missions is to build a nature and heritage center on the island. So we do hope down the road we will be able to show some of those artifacts.
That sounds like a good goal. So then after that, then came the Spanish settlers. When did they get there?
They got there in the
1500s.
Yeah.
They got to the island in the 1500s. Wow.
Yeah, they were in that area. They have records that 1513 was probably around that period of time when the first Spanish came in.
Was there any coexistence there for any period of time that they know about or any of that documented as far as the Spanish staying on that particular island along with the Calusa?
There that's very interesting. There have been reports that the Calusa were used by the Spanish to show them like fishing holes and things like that. However, right now I'm reading a book actually of transcribed papers that were in Spanish and the Spanish, they came in as the conquistadors wanting to take over. Mm-hmm. And they did not like the fact that the Calusas had their own religion and they were a very complex society. And so the Calusas were opposed to the Spanish coming in and trying to convert them to Christianity. So there was a lot of resistance for hundreds of years, actually.
I don't know if there's any way to know. Did the Calusa then leave the island or were there battles? Do we know anything about that?
We don't have any, at least not that I'm aware of, any documented battles. We do know that the Calusa fought them off. The Calusa were they were all throughout Southwest Florida. They were a very strong culture. And most of the Indian tribes, the Native Americans that were surrounding the Calusa territory, all paid tribute to the Calusa king because they were such fierce warriors. Mm-hmm. And I'm so sorry.
No, I'm just wondering. So, how did they end up? They ended up leaving, and then.
Most of the Calusa left the whole area or died off eventually through disease. And that kind of thing. So what we've tried to do with this film is really start at the point of the Spanish settlers who were fisher folk who came from the Canary Islands originally, and settled on Cayo Costa and many other islands.
So, let's get into the documentary. It's called Mullet and Mangroves. It's subtitled The Pioneer Fishing Families of Cayo Costa Island. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the Padilla family.
The Padilla family arrived from via Key West to Cayo Costa, and they settled, and they had a very, very large family. And for generations, most of the descendants that you see featured in the film originated through that family line. And although they have many different surnames now, they originally came through the Padilla line. And the fascinating history about how they survived on that island, with their sustenance from the sea, basically. And
I'm sitting here talking about air conditioning earlier, you know? And we're like, you can be there if you have a generator and you have an air – you can have electricity.
But they didn't have any of those things.
How did they? Did they just – What did they do?
Well, one thing, they had shotgun houses, mm-hmm. they called them. So there was a door in the front, and the back door was right in the same – in the middle part of the house. So they would open those doors mm-hmm. to allow those breezes to come through. So mm-hmm. that would help. And they used nature just like the Calusas did. They used mm-hmm. everything around them. So like when the mosquitoes were bad, they'd cut off a palmetto and start swatting the mosquitoes away or use them to fan themselves. So –
Yeah, I'm wondering about that. I mean, you know, historically the mosquitoes, I'm sure, but I mean, they're still there. What's the bug situation out there like for visitors now?
Well, at this time of year, it can be a challenge, though it certainly doesn't seem to have stopped our campers. We still have people who are so enthusiastic about going out there and staying in the cabins or camping all year round.
So, I mean, there are mosquitoes, but they're not terrible, terrible. They're not bad enough to keep people away.
Right.
There you go. All people.
Yeah. So let's get back into history. So how did the kids go to school? You said they had a huge family.
Yes, they did. And one of the exciting things that we've been able to uncover through this documentary is the experiences of some of these very people as they boated to school. And the school was on Punta Blanca, a different island. And the children would get picked up there. They'd get picked up at Cabbage Key. They'd get picked up at the various islands and boated to school for a long period of time. We have history about the various teachers who taught in the school and some of the activities. That's one of the things we try to cover in the film. And one of the things we try to share with young people now so that they understand that going to school was pretty difficult. You had to be very committed.
Yeah, I mean, you have to take a boat to get there. That's kind of like the equivalent, I guess, up north of going uphill both ways in a foot of snow, right? We hear about that from everybody. So the descendants that you found, how did you find them and where were they? Were they all over the place? Did they mm-hmm. descendants stay on the island or they still have a connection there at all?
No, they didn't. They're primarily on Pine Island and in Boca Grande is where we have found most of the descendants, some on Captiva. But they truly are spread all over. And one of the things that we've discovered when in developing this film and people hearing about it is some of the descendants who are calling us and said, can we get a copy, please? Can we get a copy? Because we are part of that family. Yeah. And that's pretty exciting for us.
And one of the things that I think about all the time when I think about the Gulf and back in that era when the Padillas originally got there is I'm thinking about bootlegging and rum and mm-hmm. pirates running. Did that happen?
Yes, it did. And we talk about that in the film as well. At least one of our special people who's covered in the film talks about his family, Stanley Darna, and mm-hmm. his family who did, in fact, make part of their living bootlegging. And, of course, the families were challenged economically, and in later years with the net fishing ban, that's really when they mostly left the island because they could no longer make a living with fishing, commercial fishing.
That mm-hmm. and also when the school boat stopped.
And yes. When the school boat stopped, then they moved off the island so they could make certain that their children could attend school.
So tell me a little bit about Captain Peter Nelson.
Interesting character.
Who wants to tell me about this guy?
A very interesting character. Well, he supposedly was the illegitimate son of the Danish king. He obviously was a very intelligent man. He was a county commissioner. He started the town of Alva. He later on retired at Cayo Costa. He was the postman, and I think he acted as a school teacher certain period of time as well. And he also did a little bit of harbor piloting, if mm-hmm. I remember Robert mentioning that. So he did a little bit of everything. He was a very well-known, very well-respected person.
Yeah, I understand that he's still buried in the cemetery there.
He is, yeah. He is. That's one of the exciting things. There's actually two cemeteries on the island, but the one that is very easy to find on the trail is it's easily recognized because it's marked with his name.
You know, I know it sounds a little bit, you know, morbid or gothic. I just love cemeteries. I just think they're such a fun way to look at history, you know, mm-hmm. looking at who's there, how long lifespans were. There's so much that you can kind of glean from that. Are there headstones there? I mean, can you?
They're very primitive headstones.
Right.
There are a few that have wording on them. Many, many don't.
But I'd imagine they'd wash away. I mean, there's kind of harsh elements there.
Well, and in fact, the one cemetery has mostly washed away, and that was the major Padilla family cemetery. But this cemetery is there, and one of the things that we do with Friends of Cayo Costas, we host an event in November, early November, and this year it will be November 3rd, I believe.
The Day of the Dead.
Yes. And we
– That makes sense.
Part of our event is that we do a guided history tour to the cemetery, and we talk a lot about the cemetery and about the history of the island as a whole. So we certainly would invite people to put that on their calendar and start looking for notices on our website.
You don't really see a whole lot of cemeteries in Florida for some reason, you know? You go up into the Northeast, there's tons, and for some reason I just never really see them down here in Florida. So Baron Collier, he's the man for whom Collier County is named. He plays a role in the history of Cayo Costa, correct? Am I right?
Well, in Punta Blanca.
Punta Blanca.
Yeah, so that's where the school was. So Baron actually had – he owned the island, and he actually was the one that built the school.
Well, the school was important for people to be on Cayo Costa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in order for him to – so he owned USEP as well, which was a big resort. And in order for him to have the fishing guides for the people coming to the resort wanting to fish, he had to have a way for their children to go to school. So mm-hmm. that's what he did. He built the school in Punta Blanca. So
I love this history stuff. It's so great. It's going to be such a really interesting documentary on starting tonight, I believe it is.
Tomorrow night.
If you're just joining the show, we're talking with Elaine McLaughlin from Friends of Cayo Costa, and it's a nonprofit that works with the Florida Park Service to support Cayo Costa State Park. We're also talking with Sharon McKenzie. She's from the Barrier Island Parks Society. It's a nonprofit that works to protect and inform the public about the history of several island state parks, including Cayo Costa. We're exploring the deep history, and if you'd like to join the show, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So at what point did this turn from being where the Padilla family and other families lived into a state park area? When did it become a state park?
That happened
in the mid-'80s,
yes.
All right. So who owned it until then?
Lee County owned a park. Portion of the land, and then I think they turned that over to the state to manage the state park.
So the county turned over the portion that they had to the state, and then the state had also bought some additional mm-hmm. parcels to expand it. And that was a goal to eventually buy whatever parcels were available.
And it continues to be a goal, we hope.
Yes.
Yeah. So what sort of facilities are out there on the island? If you decide to go and take a ferry boat and get out there, mm-hmm. what do you expect to find? Are there restrooms? Are there showers?
Mm-hmm. Both of those. There's a restroom just as you get off the ferry. There's another one over by the campsite, and we're very excited because there's going to be a brand new facility there. That was funded through the Tourist Development Council
of Lee County.
And so that bathhouse and restroom is going to begin construction very shortly. I think it's in design now.
Is there anything people can't take out there?
There are some rules that the ferry operator has that there are certain limitations in how much bulk they take and how many pounds they take when
I
they're
just
going
see, like,
camping.
Giant inflatables, you know.
You see a lot of things. So people take their own kayaks and put them on top of the ferry boat. They take beach chairs. Everything. When you're going to the beach for the day, everything that you would see going to any beach, you see going out there.
You know, I heard you say gift shop.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a restaurant? So you have to bring your own food.
You have to bring your own food.
So our gift shop actually carries snacks and ice cream and drinks, and they actually carry some things for the campers. So there's some hot dogs and things like that, but they don't actually sell cooked hot dogs.
Like, yeah,
you would have to build a fire and cook it yourself. Mm-hmm. So
all right,
it is
great.
Primitive.
Are there? For people that decide to go out and stay, there are cabins then that are available.
There are cabins. They're primitive cabins. There is no air conditioning and there is no electricity. And the restroom is the shared common campground restroom. and bathos. But
talking like bringing out sleeping bags and cots or what?
Exactly.
Okay, bare bones.
Bring your sleeping bag. There are beds. There are beds, bunk beds and beds.
But there's
in
no
the cabin.
Sheets or pillows
no.
or
no. –
yeah, so you have to bring everything.
All right. So it's primitive, but it's rough.
But you know what? Those cabins and the tent sites are reserved through the state park system, which is Reserve America, and they keep pretty busy and pretty full, especially in the wintertime, you can imagine.
How many – yeah. That would be the best, probably, I would imagine, weather time to go. But still more crowded. I mean, how many people visit the island every year?
About 86,000 people visited the island last year.
86,000?
Yep.
That's a lot of boat trips.
It is a lot of boat trips. Yes, it is.
Wow. Do you have school trips go out there?
Yes. One of the things that Friends of Cayo Costa is looking at doing is partnering on a new program called the Yellow Bus Program. And currently we also work with the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation and their program through one of our board members, Richard Finkel, who manages that. We just did a trip there, in fact, with children from there was a group from Immokalee and another group from Mount Lachey went out in the last few weeks.
You know, I'm intrigued by the fact that it has never been developed. I mean, is it big enough for someone to want to develop on?
Certainly.
It's big enough, but I mean, is there a reason why they didn't? I mean, it didn't become a park until the 80s. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe the development hadn't reached that part until then, and now is it protected? Is there any risk of it becoming developed?
Well, certainly not in the state park part of the island. There's probably still an opportunity for some single-family housing development to happen at the south end, but it's
there's
very difficult, and it's very expensive to build on a barrier island with no
infrastructure,
no bridge
right.
access.
I mean, just to take to bring cargo, like larger items over, it costs about $900 one way just to bring out.
Wow.
And so it's very expensive.
And that's actually one of the things that the Friends of Cayo Costa have been doing is we have built a vehicle lift station for the Park Service to repair their own vehicles, specifically because in order to barge a vehicle to be repaired off the island and back on again is so terribly expensive. So now they have the ability to repair it right on the island. We just funded that this past year.
Yeah, that would make sense because getting your big, you know, lawnmower or whatever, getting that off and the tractors and stuff.
Yeah.
Before we wrap things up, I want to talk to you a little bit about sea turtles. What kind of a role does Cayo Costa play in the nesting habits of sea turtles?
Oh, we're so excited you've asked that question. The park rangers have an active program, park management, in managing the nest and protecting the nest. They have two FGCU interns there working all summer this year. And we have several volunteers who help with the turtle nest protection program. And we at Friends of Cayo Costa have an adopt-a-nest program where you can adopt a nest for yourself or your grandchild perhaps. You can do that via our website, and we certainly encourage it. This year we have very active nests. We're almost at 200 nests on the island. So far this year.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yes, we're so thrilled about that. And so we're very much encouraging the Adopt a Nest program because that helps us to fund the materials that are needed to protect the nest. It's quite expensive to buy all of the materials that are required.
It's like netting and things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we last year bought a beach patrol vehicle because if you think about it, 7 miles of beach, that's a long way for people to walk as they're going to monitor the nest, to protect the nest. So we bought the park staff and the volunteers who work the nest a vehicle in order that they can go up and down the beach and monitor the nest.
And speaking of patrolling, you know, for the turtle nest, I'm wondering, do you ever have any, you know, straggler that didn't make the last ferry off the island that gets stuck out there?
Yes, that does happen. That does happen. And the ferry services are usually very good about trying to handle it or
do a head count on the way in.
They're very clear about a head count, and they have a whole system that manages that. They go out from Pine Island on the Tropic Star from Captiva. They go out on Captiva cruises, and from Punta Gorda, they go out on Fisher.
You're talking about from Punta Gorda, the mm-hmm. Fisher. Oh, golly.
Yeah, I know we're blocking
terrible.
Both of us. That's terrible.
Fisherman's Wharf?
No.
Well,
it comes out of Fisherman's Wharf. But yes, we're
That's okay. We probably have it on our website.
Yes. It's certainly on our website.
Tell me your website again real quick.
It's friendsofcayocosta.org.
Okay. So if you want to get out there and you want to get all these particulars that we've been talking about and may have not scratched anything down on a notepad while you're driving, you can always just check that. friendsofcayocosta.org.
Yes. And we would love for you to join us in helping us support the island and protect the island.
And one last question before we go. Have you seen any evidence of red tide issues up there? I know that we've been doing a lot of stories about that.
Yeah.
And I know I've been hearing that further north you go, it's a little bit more evident.
Right. We are seeing some, but what I'm hearing is that it moves in and out. So there are days when you can feel the red tide more clearly, and then there are other days when it's washed out.
It's been flushing itself. A couple weeks ago it was really bad, but it's been flushing itself out. So
it kind of comes and goes. And,
it
you know,
does.
We did a thing about the sea turtles, and now that this red tide has just continued to persist on into the summer when they're coming in for nesting, there have been concerns about that. But I'm sure your patrol that you have going up and down the beach would see if you have any compromised turtles as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, got to keep an eye out for those guys. Well, that's all the time we've got for this part of the show. I want to thank my guests, Elaine McLaughlin. She's the volunteer chair for Friends of Cayocosta. Elaine, thanks so much for being here today. Great stories.
Thank you so much for having us. We sure appreciate it.
And also I want to thank Sharon McKenzie. She's the executive director of the Barrier Island Parks Society. Sharon, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Julie. Appreciate it.
The new independent documentary Mullet and Mangroves airs on WGCU TV starting tomorrow night at 8 p.m. When we return, we're talking about beef and efforts to make it healthier. We'll talk with a University of Florida researcher to get the skinny on the fats in red meat. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.